Then work with them individually or together and teach them good relational and conversational skills. But there are times this just isn't possible. If even just one of them is emotionally dysregulated, it can prevent anything like a peaceful resolution, since reactivity is trumping receptivity. Sometimes the best you can do is separate them until you can all come together again once everyone has calmed down. And if cruel fate decrees that you're all trapped in the minivan when the conflict erupts, you may just need to explicitly acknowledge that things are not going well and turn up the music. In doing so, you're not surrendering. You're just acknowledging that at this moment, effective discipline isn't going to happen. In cases like this, you can say, "This isn't a good time for us to talk this through. You're both mad, and I'm mad, so let's just listen to some Fleetwood Mac." Okay, maybe that's not the best choice in music to win your kids over, but you get the idea. We, Dan and Tina, are both trained child and adolescent psychotherapists who write books about parenting. People come to us for advice on how to handle problems when their kids are struggling. And we want to make it clear that for us, like you, there are times when there just isn't a magic wand we can wave to magically transport our kids to peace and happiness. Sometimes the best we can do is to communicate our love, be available when they do want us close, and then talk about the situation when they're ready. It's just like the Serenity Prayer says, "May I have the courage to change the things I can, the serenity to accept the things I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference." So that's our first message as we conclude the book. Sometimes there's no magic wand, and it doesn't make you a bad parent if you do your best and your child stays upset. Second message of hope. Your kids benefit even when you mess up. Just as it doesn't make you a bad parent if your discipline techniques aren't always effective in the moment, you're also not a bad parent if you make mistakes on a regular basis. What you are is human. The fact is that none of us are perfect, especially when it comes time to deal with our kids' behavior. Sometimes we handle ourselves well and feel proud of how loving, understanding, and patient we remain. At other times, we lower ourselves to our kids' level and resort to the childishness that upset us in the first place. Our second message of hope is that when you respond to your kids from a less than optimal place, you can take heart. Most likely, you're still providing them with all kinds of valuable experiences. For example, have you ever found yourself so frustrated with your kids that you call out a good bit louder than you need to, "That's it! The next one who complains about where they're sitting in the car can walk." Or maybe when your 8-year-old pouts and complains all the way to school because you made her practice the piano, you deliver these sarcastic and biting words as she departs the minivan: "I hope you have a great day now that you've ruined the whole morning." Obviously, these aren't examples of optimal parenting. And if you're like us, you can be hard on yourself for the times you don't handle things like you wish you had. So here's hope. Those not-so-great parenting moments are not necessarily such bad things for our kids to have to go through. In fact, they're actually incredibly valuable. Why? Because our messy, human, parental responses give kids opportunities to deal with difficult situations and therefore develop new skills. They have to learn to control themselves, even though their parent isn't doing such a great job of controlling herself. Then they get to see you model how to apologize and make things right. They experience that when there is conflict and argument, there can be repair, and things become good again. This helps them feel safe and not so afraid in future relationships. They learn to trust and even expect that calm and connection will follow conflict. Plus, they learn that their actions affect other people's emotions and behavior. Finally, they see that you're not perfect, so they won't expect themselves to be either. That's a lot of important lessons to learn from one parent's loud, impulsive declaration that he's sending back all the presents because his kids complained about having to help put up the holiday decorations. Abuse, of course, is different, whether physical or psychological. Or if you're significantly harming the relationship or scaring your child, then the experience can result in substantially harmful effects. These are toxic ruptures, and ruptures without repair. If you find yourself in that situation repeatedly, you should seek the help of a professional right away in order to make whatever changes are necessary so that your children are safe and know that they are protected. But as long as you nurture the relationship and repair with your child afterward, more coming up about that soon, then you can cut yourself some slack and know that even though you might wish you'd done things differently, you've still given your child a valuable experience by learning the importance of repair and reconnection. We hope it's obvious that we're not saying that parents should intentionally rupture a connection or that we shouldn't aim for the best when we respond to our kids in a high-stress situation or any other time. The more loving and nurturing we can be, the better. Those non-ideal moments of non-optimal interactions will happen to all of us, even those of us who write books on this subject. We're just saying that we can offer grace and forgiveness to ourselves when we're not acting as we'd like to, because even those situations provide moments of value as well. Having a goal, an intention in mind, is important, and being kind to ourselves, having self-compassion, is essential not only to create an internal sanctuary, but also to offer our children a role model for being kind to themselves as well as to others. These experiences with us give our kids opportunities to learn important lessons that will prepare them for future conflict and relationships, and even teach them how to love. How's that for hope? Third message of hope. You can always reconnect. There's no way we can avoid experiencing conflict with our kids. It's going to happen, sometimes multiple times per day. Misunderstandings, arguments, conflicting desires, and other breakdowns in communication will lead to a rupture in the relationship. Ruptures can result from conflict around a limit that you're setting. Maybe you decide to enforce a bedtime or keep your child from seeing a movie you've decided isn't good for him. Or maybe your daughter thinks you're taking her sister's side in an argument, or she gets frustrated that you won't play another game of chutes and ladders. Whatever the reason ruptures occur, sometimes they are bigger, sometimes smaller, but there's no way to avoid them. Each child presents a unique challenge to maintaining attuned connection, one that depends on our own issues, on our child's temperament, on the match between our history and our child's characteristics, and on whom our child may remind us of in our own unworked-through past. In most of our adult relationships, if we mess up, we eventually own up to it, or address it in some way, and then make amends. But many parents, when it comes to their relationship with their child, just ignore the rupture and never address it. This can be confusing and hurtful for children, just like it can be for adults. Can you imagine someone you care about being reactive and talking to you really rudely, then never bringing it up again and just pretending it never happened? That wouldn't feel great, would it? It's the same for our kids. What's key, then, is that you repair any breach in the relationship as quickly as possible. You want to restore a collaborative, nurturing connection with your child. Ruptures without repair leave both parent and child feeling disconnected. And if that disconnection is prolonged, and especially if it's associated with your anger, hostility, or rage, then toxic shame and humiliation can grow in the child, damaging her emerging sense of self and her state of mind about how relationships work. It's therefore vital that we make a timely reconnection with our kids after there's been a rupture. It's our responsibility as parents to do this. Maybe we reconnect by granting forgiveness or by asking for it. I'm sorry, I think I was just reacting because I'm extra tired today, but I know I didn't handle myself very well. I'll listen if you want to talk about what that was like for you. Maybe laughter's involved, maybe tears. Well, that didn't go very well, did it? Anyone care to play back for me how crazy I was? Maybe there's just a quick acknowledgement. I didn't handle that how I would have liked. Will you forgive me? However it happens, make it happen. By repairing and reconnecting as soon as we can, and in a sincere and loving manner, we reconnect and send the message that the relationship matters more than whatever caused the conflict. Plus, in reconnecting with our kids, we model for them a crucial skill that will allow them to enjoy much more meaningful relationships as they grow up. So that's the third message of hope. We can always reconnect. Even though there's no magic wand, our kids will eventually soften and calm down. They'll eventually be ready to sense our positive intentions and receive our love and comfort. When they do, we reconnect. And even though we're going to mess up as parents over and over again, because we are human, we can always go to our kids and repair the breach. In the end, then, it all comes back to connection. Yes, we want to redirect, we want to teach. Our children need us to help them learn how to focus their desires in positive ways, how to recognize and deal with limits and boundaries, how to discover what it means to be human and to be moral, ethical, empathic, kind, and giving. So, yes, redirection is crucial. But ultimately, it's your relationship with your child that must always stay at the forefront of your mind. Put any particular behavior on the back burner and keep your relationship with your child always on the front burner. Once that relationship has been ruptured in any way, reconnect as soon as possible. Fourth message of hope. It's never too late to make a positive change. Our final message for you is the most hopeful of all. It's never too late to make a positive change. Having heard this book, you may now feel that your discipline approach up to this point has at least partially run counter to what's best for your children. Perhaps you feel that you're undermining your relationship with them by the way you discipline. Or maybe you realize that you're overlooking and missing out on opportunities to build the parts of their brains that will help them achieve optimal growth. You might now see that you're using disciplinary strategies that are simply not effective, are just contributing to more drama and frustration in your family, and are actually keeping you from enjoying your kids because you end up having to deal with the same behaviors over and over. If any of that's the case, have hope. It's not too late. Neuroplasticity, as we've said, shows us that the brain is amazingly changeable and adaptive across a lifetime. You can change the way you discipline at any age, yours or your child's. No drama discipline shows you how. Not by offering a formula to follow. Not by providing a magic wand that will solve every problem and make you a parent who never misses the mark. The hope comes in that you now have principles that can guide you toward disciplining your children in ways you can feel good about. You now have access to strategies that actually sculpt the brain in positive ways, allow your kids to be emotionally intelligent and make good choices, strengthen your relationship with them, and help them become the kind of people you want them to be. When you respond to your kids with connection, even and especially when they do something that frustrates you, you put your primary focus not on punishment or obedience, but on honoring both your child and the relationship. So the next time your toddler throws a tantrum, your second grader punches his sister, or your middle schooler talks back, you can choose to respond in a no-drama, whole-brain fashion. You can begin with connection, then move on to redirection strategies that teach kids personal insight, relational empathy, and the importance of taking responsibility for the times they mess up. Along the way, you can be more intentional about how you activate certain circuits of your kids' brains. Neurons that fire together wire together. The circuitry that is repeatedly activated will be strengthened and further developed. So the question is, which part of your kids' brains do you want to strengthen? Discipline with harshness, shouting, arguments, punishment, and rigidity, and you'll activate the downstairs reactive part of your child's brain, strengthening that circuitry and priming it to be easily activated. Or discipline with calm, loving connection, and you'll activate the reflective, receptive, regulating mindsight circuitry, strengthening and developing the upstairs section of the brain to create insight, empathy, integration, and repair. Right now, in this moment, you can commit to giving your children these valuable tools. You can help them develop this increased capacity to regulate themselves, to make good choices, and to handle themselves well, even in challenging times and even when you're not around. You're not going to be perfect, and you're not going to discipline from a no-drama, whole-brain perspective every time you get the chance. Neither do we. Nobody does. But you can decide that you'll take steps in that direction. And every step you take, you'll give your kids the gift of a parent who is increasingly committed to their lifelong success and happiness and to making them happy, healthy, and fully themselves.
Further resources. Connect and redirect summary. First, connect. Why connect first? Short-term benefit. It moves a child from reactivity to receptivity. Long-term benefit. It builds a child's brain. Relational benefit. It deepens your relationship with your child. No drama connection principles. Turn down the shark music. Let go of the background noise caused by past experiences and future fears. Chase the why. Instead of focusing only on behavior, look for what's behind the actions. Why is my child acting this way? What is my child communicating? Think about the how. What you say is important, but just as important, if not more important, is how you say it. The no drama connection cycle. Help your child feel felt. Communicate comfort. By getting below your child's eye level, then giving a loving touch, a nod of the head, or an empathic look, you can often quickly diffuse a heated situation. Validate. Even when you don't like the behavior, acknowledge and even embrace feelings. Stop talking and listen. When your child's emotions are exploding, don't explain, lecture, or try to talk her out of her feelings. Just listen, looking for the meaning and emotions your child is communicating. Reflect what you hear. Once you've listened, reflect back what you've heard, letting your kids know you've heard them. That leads back to communicating comfort, and the cycle repeats. Then, redirect. 1-2-3 discipline, the no drama way. One definition. Discipline is teaching. Ask the three questions. 1. Why did my child act this way? What was happening internally, emotionally? 2. What lesson do I want to teach? 3. How can I best teach it? 2 principles. 1. Wait until your child is ready. And you are too. 2. Be consistent, but not rigid. 3 mindsight outcomes. 1. Insight. Help kids understand their own feelings and their responses to difficult situations. 2. Empathy. Give kids practice reflecting on how their actions impact others. Number 3, repair. Ask kids what they can do to make things right. No drama redirection strategies. R. Reduce words. E. Embrace emotions. D. Describe, don't preach. I. Involve your child in the discipline. R. Reframe a no into a yes with conditions. E. Emphasize the positive. C. Creatively approach the situation. T. Teach mindsight tools.
When a parenting expert loses it, you're not the only one. Just because we write books about parenting and discipline doesn't mean there aren't times when we mess up with our own kids. Here are two stories, one from each of us, that, while pretty funny in retrospect, show that the reactive brain can get us all. My Crepes of Wrath Moment, adapted from my book, Mindsight. One day, my 13-year-old son, my 9-year-old daughter, and I stopped into a small shop for a snack after a movie. My daughter said she wasn't hungry, and so my son ordered a small crepe for himself from the counter, and we sat down. The simple crepe arrived, aromas wafting from the open kitchen behind the counter where my son had placed his order. After my son took his first forkful of crepe, my daughter asked if she could try some. My son looked at the small crepe and said that he was hungry and she could order her own. It was a reasonable suggestion, I thought, so I offered to get another crepe for her. But she said she wanted only a small bite to see how it tasted. That also seemed reasonable, so I suggested that my son share a piece with his sister. If you have more than one child at home, or if you've grown up with a brother or sister, you may be very familiar with the game of sibling chess, an ever-present strategy match composed of movements aimed to assert power and achieve parental recognition and approval. But even if this was not such a sibling assertion game, the small cost of buying the additional crepe from this little family-run crepe shop would have been quite a simple one to pay to avoid what you may guess was about to happen. Instead of making the purchase, I made a parental blunder and took sides in this sibling game. I firmly insisted that my son share his crepe with his sister. If this was not a sibling chess match before, it certainly became one after I stepped into their interaction. "Why don't you just give her a small piece so she can see how it tastes?" I urged. He looked at me, then at his crepe, and with a sigh he gave in. Even as a young teenager, he was still listening to me. Then, using his knife like a scalpel, he extracted the smallest piece of crepe you can imagine, one you'd almost need tweezers to pick up. Under other circumstances, I might have laughed and seen this as a creative move in the sibling chess game. My daughter took the specimen, placed it on her napkin, and said that it was too small, and that it was the burnt part, another great younger sister move. An outsider looking in at us at the table may have seen nothing out of the ordinary, a dad and his two animated kids out for some food. But inside, I was about to explode. When the bantering continued, turning into a full-blown argument, something inside me shifted. My head began to spin, but I told myself that I'd remain calm and appeal to reason. I could feel my face tense up, my fists get taut, and my heart began to beat faster. But I tried to ignore these signals that my downstairs brain was hijacking the upstairs. That was it for me. Feeling overwhelmed by the ridiculousness of the whole encounter, I got up, took my daughter's hand, and went outside to wait on the sidewalk in front of the shop until my son finished his crepe. A few minutes later, he emerged and asked why we had left. As I stormed off toward the car, my daughter in tow and my son hurrying to keep up, I told them that they should learn to share their food with each other. He pointed out, in a matter-of-fact tone, that he did give her a piece. But by then, I was boiling over with frustration, and at that point, there was no turning off the heat under the kettle. We got to the car, and, fired up, I ignited the engine, and away we went toward home. They had been normal siblings out for movies and a snack, and I became a father out of my mind. I couldn't let it go. Sitting next to me in the passenger seat, my son countered everything I came up with by some rational, measured response, as any teenager would do. In fact, he seemed quite adept at staying calm as he dealt with his now irrational father. In that state, I became more and more irate, eventually resorting to cursing, calling him names, and even threatening to take away his beloved guitar, all inappropriate consequences for things he didn't even do. I'm not proud to tell you any of this, but Tina and I do feel that since such explosive episodes are quite common, it is essential that we acknowledge their existence and help each other understand how mindsight can diminish their negative impact on our relationships and on our world. In our shame, we often try to ignore that a meltdown has occurred. But if we own the truth of what has happened, we can not only begin to repair the damage, which can be quite toxic to ourselves as well as to others, but actually decrease the intensity of such events and the frequency with which they occur. So, when I got home, I realized that I needed to calm down and connect with my son. I knew repair was crucial, but my vital signs were through the roof, and I had to bring them into balance before doing anything else. Knowing that being outside and exercising could help alter my state of mind, I went skating with my daughter, during which time she helped me regain mindsight. I achieved more personal insight, recognizing that I reacted to my son the way I did, at least partially, because I was unconsciously identifying him with my own older brother, and empathy for how my son experienced our encounter. When I finally cooled down after talking and skating and reflecting, I went to my son's room and asked if we could talk. I said that I thought I had gone off the deep end, and that it would be helpful for us to discuss what had happened. He told me that he thought I was too protective of his sister. He was absolutely right. Although the embarrassment of having become irrational created an urge to speak up to defend myself and my reactions, I just kept quiet. My son went on to tell me that my getting upset was unnecessary because he really hadn't done anything wrong. He was right. Again, I felt a defensive urge to lecture him about sharing, but I reminded myself to remain reflective and focus on my son's experience, not mine. The essential stance here was not to judge who was right, but to be accepting and receptive to him. You can imagine that this all required mindsight for sure. I was thankful my prefrontal region was back at work. After listening to him, I acknowledged that I had in fact taken his sister's side unfairly, that I could see how this felt unjust to him, and that my explosion seemed irrational because, in fact, it was. As an explanation, not an excuse, I let him know what had happened in my mind, seeing him as a symbol of my brother, so that we both could make sense of the whole encounter. Even though I probably looked awkward and clumsy in his teenage mind, I could tell that he knew my commitment to our relationship was deep, and my effort to repair the damage was genuine. My mindsight had returned, our two minds connected again, and our relationship was back on track.
I threaten an amputation. When my oldest child was 3 years old, he hit me one day. As a young and idealistic parent who, at that time, believed that my best alternative was to have a rational conversation with a three-year-old, in which he would magically see things from my point of view, I guided him to the bottom of our stairway, sat next to him, and smiled. I lovingly and naively said, "Hands are for helping and loving, not for hurting." While I was uttering this truism, he hit me again. So I tried the empathy approach. Still naive, my voice perhaps sounding a bit less loving, I said, "Ouch, that hurts, Mommy. Be gentle with my body." At which point, he hit me again. I then tried a more firm approach. Hitting is not okay. We don't hit. If you're mad, you need to use your words. Yep, you guessed it. He hit me again. I was lost. I felt I needed to up the ante, but I didn't know how. In my most powerful voice, I said, "Now you're in timeout at the top of the stairs." The technical scientific term for this parenting strategy is flying by the seat of your pants. Not exactly intentional parenting. I marched him to the top of our stairs. He was probably thinking, "Cool, we've never done this before. I wonder what will happen next if I keep hitting her." At the top of the stairs, I bent over at the waist, my finger wagging, and said, "No more hitting." He didn't hit me again. He kicked me in the shin. As he points out these days when we retell the story, he was technically obeying my no-hitting instructions. At this moment, virtually all of my self-control was gone, as were any viable options I could think of. I grabbed his arm and pulled him into my room at the top of the stairs, yelling, "Now you're in timeout in Mommy and Daddy's room!" Again, I had no strategy, no plan, or approach. And as a result, my young son continued to escalate the situation while his increasingly red-faced mother yanked him from location to location in the house. By this point, I was by turns cajoling, scolding, commanding, reacting, and reasoning. Way too much talking. "You may not hurt Mommy. Hitting and kicking are not how we do things in our family. Blah, blah, blah." And that's when he made his biggest mistake. He stuck out his tongue at me. In response, my rational, empathic, responsible, problem-solving upstairs brain was hijacked by my primitive, reactive downstairs brain, and I yelled, "If you stick that tongue out one more time, I'm gonna rip it out of your mouth." In case you're wondering, neither Dan nor I recommend in any circumstance threatening to remove any of your children's body parts. This was not a good parenting moment. And it wasn't effective discipline either. My son dropped to the ground, crying. I'd scared him. And he kept saying, "You're a mean mommy." He wasn't thinking about his own behavior at all. He was solely focused on my misbehavior. What I did next was probably the only thing I did right in the whole interaction. And it's essential each time we have these types of ruptures in our relationship with our children. I repaired with him. I immediately realized how awful I'd been in that reactive, angry moment. If anyone else had treated my child as I just had, I would have come unglued. I knelt down and joined my young son on the floor, held him close, and told him how sorry I was. I let him talk about how much he didn't like what had just occurred. We retold the story to make sense of it for him, and I comforted him. I usually get big laughs when I tell this story because parents so identify with this type of moment. And I think they enjoy hearing that a parenting expert can totally lose it too. As I explain to my audiences, we need to be patient, understanding, and forgiving, not only with our children, but with ourselves as well. People always ask what I would do differently now. Listen to Chapter 6, where we discuss addressing toddler misbehavior in 4 steps. Though these stories are a bit embarrassing to relate, we offer them as, yes, humorous, evidence that we are all potentially prone to such downstairs disintegrations when we lose control and handle ourselves poorly. Episodes like these shouldn't become a regular occurrence, though. If you find yourself repeatedly losing it in intense ways, we recommend that you consider seeking professional help to assist you in making sense of your own emotional needs or woundings that may be contributing to frequently reactive ways of relating to your children. But if you go down the low road every so often, as most of us do, that's just part of parenting. The key is recognizing when these moments happen, putting an end to them as quickly as possible to minimize the hurt they cause, and then making a repair. We need to regain what was truly lost, mind sight, and then use insight and empathy to reconnect with ourselves and repair with those for whom we care so deeply. A note to our child's caregivers. Our discipline approach in a nutshell. You are an important person in the life of our child or children. You're helping determine who they're becoming by shaping their hearts, their character, and even the structures of their brains. Because we share this incredible privilege and responsibility of teaching them how to make good choices and how to be kind, successful human beings, we want to also share with you how we handle behavioral challenges in hopes that we can work together to give our children a consistent, effective experience when it comes to discipline. Here are the 8 basic principles that guide us. 1. Discipline is essential. We believe that loving our kids and giving them what they need includes setting clear and consistent boundaries and holding high expectations for them, all of which helps them achieve success in relationships and other areas of their lives. 2. Effective discipline depends on a loving, respectful relationship between adult and child. Discipline should never include threats or humiliation, cause physical pain, scare children, or make them feel that the adult is the enemy. Discipline should feel safe and loving to everyone involved. 3. The goal of discipline is to teach. We use discipline moments to build skills so kids can handle themselves better now and make better decisions in the future. There are usually better ways to teach than giving immediate consequences. Instead of punishment, we encourage cooperation from our kids by helping them think about their actions and by being creative and playful. We set limits by having a conversation to help develop awareness and skills that lead to better behavior both today and tomorrow. 4. The first step in discipline is to pay attention to kids' emotions. When children misbehave, it's usually the result of not handling big feelings well and not yet having the skills to make good choices. So being attentive to the emotional experience behind a behavior is just as important as the behavior itself. In fact, science shows that addressing kids' emotional needs is actually the most effective approach to changing behavior over time, as well as developing their brains in ways that allow them to handle themselves better as they grow up. 5. When children are upset or throwing a fit, that's when they need us most. We need to show them we are there for them and that we'll be there for them at their absolute worst. This is how we build trust and a feeling of overall safety. 6. Sometimes we need to wait until children are ready to learn. If kids are upset or out of control, that's the worst time to try to teach them. Those big emotions are evidence that our children need us. Our first job is to help them calm down so they can regain control and handle themselves well. 7. The way we help them be ready to learn is to connect with them. Before we redirect their behavior, we connect and comfort. Just like we soothe them when they are physically hurt, we do the same when they're emotionally upset. We do this by validating their feelings and by giving them lots of nurturing empathy. Before we teach, we connect. 8. After connecting, we redirect. Once they've felt that connection with us, kids will be more ready to learn so we can effectively redirect them and talk with them about their behavior. What do we hope to accomplish when we redirect and set limits? We want our kids to gain insight into themselves, empathy for others, and the ability to make things right when they make mistakes. For us, discipline comes down to one simple phrase, connect and redirect. Our first response should always be to offer soothing connection. Then we can redirect behaviors. Even when we say no to children's behavior, we always want to say yes to their emotions and to the way they experience things. 20 discipline mistakes even great parents make. Because we're always parenting our children, it takes real effort to look at our discipline strategies objectively. Good intentions can be replaced by less than effective habits quickly, and that can leave us operating blindly, disciplining in ways that might not bring out our best, or the best in our children. Here are some common discipline mistakes made by even the best-intentioned, most well-informed parents. These mistakes crop up when we lose sight of our no-drama, whole-brain goals. Keeping them in mind can help us to avoid them or to step back when we start heading down the low road. 1. Our discipline becomes consequence-based instead of teaching-based. The goal of discipline is not to make sure that each infraction is immediately met with a consequence. The real goal is to teach our children how to live well in the world. But many times we discipline on autopilot and we focus so much on the consequences that those become the end goal, the entire focus. So when you discipline, ask yourself what your real objective is. Then find a creative way to teach that lesson. You can probably find a better way to teach it without even using consequences at all. 2. We think that if we're disciplining, we can't be warm and nurturing. It really is possible to be calm, loving, and nurturing while disciplining your child. In fact, it's important to combine clear and consistent boundaries with loving empathy. Don't underestimate how powerful a kind tone of voice can be as you have a conversation with your child about the behavior you want to change. Ultimately, you're trying to remain strong and consistent in your discipline while still interacting with your child in a way that communicates warmth, love, respect, and compassion. These two aspects of parenting can and should coexist. 3. We confuse consistency with rigidity. Consistency means working from a reliable and coherent philosophy so that our kids know what we expect of them. It doesn't mean maintaining an unswerving devotion to some sort of arbitrary set of rules. So at times you might make exceptions to the rules, turn a blind eye to some sort of minor infraction, or cut your child some slack. 4. We talk too much. When kids are reactive and having a hard time listening, we often need to just be quiet. When we talk and talk at our upset children, it's usually counterproductive. We're just giving them a lot of sensory input that can further dysregulate them. Instead, use more nonverbal communication. Hold them, rub their shoulders, smile, or offer empathic facial expressions. Nod. Then, when they begin to calm down and are ready to listen, you can redirect by bringing in the words and addressing the issue on a more verbal, logical level. 5. We focus too much on the behavior and not enough on the why behind the behavior. Any good doctor knows that a symptom is only a sign that something else needs to be addressed. Children's misbehavior is usually a symptom of something else. It will keep occurring if we don't connect with our kids' feelings and their subjective experiences that lead to the behavior. The next time your child acts out, put on your Sherlock Holmes hat and look through the behavior to see what feelings, curiosity, anger, frustration, exhaustion, hunger, and so on, might be causing the behavior. 6. We forget to focus on how we say what we say. What we say to our kids matters. Of course it does. But just as important is how we say it. Although it's not easy, We want to aim for being kind and respectful every time we communicate with our kids. We won't always be able to hit this mark, but that should be our goal. 7. We communicate that our kids shouldn't experience big or negative feelings. When your child reacts intensely when something doesn't go his way, do you ever shut down that reaction? We don't mean to, but parents can often send the message that we're interested in being with our kids only if they're happy, and not when they're expressing negative emotions. We may say things like, "When you're ready to be nice, then you can rejoin the family." Instead, we want to communicate that we will be there for them even at their absolute worst. Even as we say no to certain behaviors or to how certain feelings get expressed, we want to say yes to our kids' emotions. 8. We overreact, so our kids focus on our overreaction, not their own actions. When we overshoot the mark with our discipline, if we're punitive or we're too harsh or we react too intensely, our children stop focusing on their own behavior and focus instead on how mean or unfair they feel we are. So do whatever you can to avoid building mountains out of molehills. Address the misbehavior and remove your child from the situation if you need to. Then give yourself time to calm down before saying much, so you can be calm and thoughtful when you respond. Then you can keep the focus on your child's actions rather than your own. 9. We don't repair. There's no way we can avoid experiencing conflict with our kids. And there's no way we'll always be on top of our game in how we handle ourselves. We'll be immature, reactive, and unkind at times. What's most important is that we address our own misbehavior and repair the breach in the relationship as soon as possible, most likely by offering and asking for forgiveness. By repairing as soon as we can in a sincere and loving manner, we model for our children a crucial skill that will allow them to enjoy much more meaningful relationships as they grow up. 10. We lay down the law in an emotional reactive moment, then realize we've overreacted. Sometimes our pronouncements can be a bit supersized. You can't go swimming for the rest of the summer. In these moments, give yourself permission to rectify the situation. Obviously, follow-through is important or you'll lose credibility, but you can be consistent and still get out of the bind. For example, you can offer the one more chance card by saying, "I didn't like what you did, but I'm going to give you another try at handling things the right way." You can also admit that you overreacted. "I got mad earlier and I wasn't thinking things through very well. I've thought about it again and I've changed my mind." 11. We forget that our children may sometimes need our help making good choices or calming themselves down. When our kids begin to get out of control, the temptation is to demand that they stop that right now. But sometimes, especially in the case of small children, they actually may not even be capable of immediately calming themselves down. That means you may need to move in and help them make good choices. The first step is to connect with your child, with both words and nonverbal communication, to help him understand that you're aware of his frustration. Only after this connection will he be prepared for you to redirect him toward making better choices. Remember, we often need to wait before responding to misbehavior. When our kids are out of control, that's not the best time to rigidly enforce a rule. When they are calmer and more receptive, they'll be better able to learn the lesson anyway. 12. We consider an audience when disciplining. Most of us worry too much about what other people think, especially when it comes to how we parent our kids. But it's not fair to your children to discipline differently when someone else is watching. In front of in-laws, for example, the temptation might be to be harsher or more reactive because you feel that you're being judged as a parent. So remove that temptation. Pull your child aside and quietly talk to just him without anyone else listening. Not only will this keep you from worrying how you sound to the others in the room, it will also help you get better focus from him and you can better attune to his behavior and needs. 13. We get trapped in power struggles. When our kids feel backed into a corner, they instinctually fight back or totally shut down. So, avoid the trap. Consider giving your child an out. Would you like to get a drink first and then we'll pick up the toys? Or negotiate. Let's see if we can figure out a way for both of us to get what we need. Obviously, there are some non-negotiables, but negotiation isn't a sign of weakness. It's a sign of respect for your child and her desires. You can even ask your child for help. Do you have any suggestions? You might be shocked to find out how much your child is willing to bend in order to bring about a peaceful resolution to the standoff. 14. We discipline in response to our habits and feelings instead of responding to our individual child in a particular moment. We sometimes lash out at our child because we're tired, or because that's what our parents did, or because we're fed up with his brother who's been acting up all morning. It's not fair, but it's understandable. What's called for is to reflect on our behavior, to really be in the moment with our children, and to respond only to what's taking place in that instant. This is one of the most difficult tasks of parenting, but the more we can do it, the better we can respond to our kids in loving ways. 15. We embarrass our kids by correcting them in front of others. When you have to discipline your child in public, consider her feelings. Imagine how you'd feel if your significant other called you out on something in front of other people. If possible, step out of the room or just pull her close and whisper. This isn't always possible, but when you can, show your child the respect of not adding humiliation to whatever else you need to do to address the misbehavior. After all, embarrassment will just take her focus off the lesson you want to teach, and she's unlikely to hear anything you want to tell her. 16. We assume the worst before letting our kids explain. Sometimes the situation looks bad, and it really is, but sometimes things aren't as bad as they seem. Before lowering the boom, listen to your child. She may have a good explanation. It's really frustrating to believe you have a rationale for your actions, yet to have the other person say, "I don't care, I don't want to hear it, there's no reason or excuse." Obviously, you can't be naive, and any parent needs to wear her critical thinking cap at all times. But before condemning a child for what seems obvious at first blush, find out what she has to say. Then you can decide how best to respond. 17. We dismiss our kids' experience. When a child reacts strongly to a situation, especially when the reaction seems unwarranted and even ridiculous, the temptation is to say something like, "You're just tired. Stop fussing. It's not that big of a deal." Or, "Why are you crying about this?" But statements like these minimize the child's experience. Imagine someone saying one of these phrases to you if you were upset. It's much more emotionally responsive and effective to listen, empathize, and really understand your child's experience before you respond. Even if it seems ridiculous to you, don't forget that it's very real to your child, so you don't want to dismiss something that's important to him. 18. We expect too much. Most parents would say that they know that children aren't perfect, but most parents also expect their children to behave well all the time. Further, parents often expect too much of their children when it comes to handling emotions and making good choices, much more than is developmentally appropriate. This is especially the case with a firstborn child. The other mistake we make in expecting too much is that we assume that just because our child can handle things well sometimes, she can handle things well all the time. But especially when kids are young, their capacity to make good decisions really fluctuates. Just because they can handle things well at one time doesn't mean they can at other times. 19. We let experts trump our own instincts. By experts, we mean authors and other gurus, as well as friends and family members. It's important that we avoid disciplining our kids based on what someone else thinks we ought to do. Fill your discipline toolbox with information from lots of experts and non-experts. Then listen to your own instincts as you pick and choose different aspects of different approaches that seem to apply best to your situation with your family and your unique child. 20. We're too hard on ourselves. We've found that it's often the most caring and conscientious parents who are too hard on themselves. They want to discipline well every time their kids mess up, but it's just not possible. So give yourself a break. Love your kids, set clear boundaries, discipline with love, and make up with them when you mess up. That kind of discipline is good for everyone involved.
An excerpt from The Whole Brain Child, 12 Revolutionary Strategies to Nurture Your Child's Developing Mind, by Daniel J. Siegel, M.D., and Tina Payne Bryson, Ph.D. You've had those days, right? When the sleep deprivation, the muddy cleats, the peanut butter on the new jacket, the homework battles, the Play-Doh in your computer keyboard, and the refrains of, "She started it!" leave you counting the minutes until bedtime. On these days, when you, again, have to pry a raisin from a nostril, it seems like the most you can hope for is to survive. However, when it comes to your children, you're aiming a lot higher than mere survival. Of course, you want to get through those difficult tantrum-in-the-restaurant moments. But whether you're a parent, grandparent, or other committed caregiver in a child's life, your ultimate goal is to raise kids in a way that lets them thrive. You want them to enjoy meaningful relationships, be caring and compassionate, do well in school, work hard and be responsible, and feel good about who they are. Survive, thrive. We've met with thousands of parents over the years. When we ask them what matters most to them, versions of these two goals almost always top the list. They want to survive difficult parenting moments, and they want their kids and their family to thrive. As parents ourselves, we share these same goals for our own families. In our nobler, calmer, saner moments, we care about nurturing our kids' minds, increasing their sense of wonder, and helping them reach their potential in all aspects of life. But in the more frantic, stressful, bribe the toddler into the car seat so we can rush to the soccer game moments, sometimes all we can hope for is to avoid yelling or hearing someone say, "You're so mean!" Take a moment and ask yourself, what do you really want for your children? What qualities do you hope they develop and take into their adult lives? Most likely, you want them to be happy, independent, and successful. You want them to enjoy fulfilling relationships and live a life full of meaning and purpose. Now, think about what percentage of your time you spend intentionally developing these qualities in your children. If you're like most parents, you worry that you spend too much time just trying to get through the day, and sometimes the next 5 minutes, and not enough time creating experiences that help your children thrive, both today and in the future. You might even measure yourself against some sort of perfect parent who never struggles to survive, who seemingly spends every waking second helping her children thrive. You know, the PTA president who cooks organic, fully balanced meals while reading to her kids in Latin about the importance of helping others, then escorts them to the art museum in the hybrid that plays classical music and mists lavender aromatherapy through the air conditioning vents. None of us can match up to this imaginary superparent, especially when we feel like a large percentage of our days is spent in full-blown survival mode, where we find ourselves wild-eyed and red-faced at the end of a birthday party shouting, "If there's one more argument over that bow and arrow, nobody's getting any presents." If any of this sounds familiar, we've got great news for you. the moments you are just trying to survive are actually opportunities to help your child thrive. At times, you may feel that the loving, important moments –